a ballot request form. Call 510-993-0320 if you need a paper ballot. Paper ballot requests are available till October 1st. Videos of candidate forums and introductions are at elections.pacifica.org to help you pick your favorites. Ballots are due back by October 15th.
Dear WBAI listener, we can certainly use a little help from our friends. After years of falling behind under new management, Pacifica has now gotten its financial papers in order and can apply once again for grants. That means WBAI, which is owned by the nonprofit Pacifica Foundation, can also apply for funding. And we are looking for a pro bono grant writer to help our 61-year-old station by writing grants for us. If you have time, expertise, and interest, please contact Bertol, our station manager, at bertol@wbai.org. You'd be helping to ensure the stability and growth of this historic listener-sponsored radio station. With details, please email bertol@wbai.org. That's B-E-R-T-H-O-L-D, bertol@wbai.org, with grant writer in the subject heading. Many thanks. Many, many thanks. This is listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
Yes, it's a little after 9 p.m. WBAI New York. Time for On the Count.
On the Count.
The U.S. prison system incarcerates approximately 2.5 million people, the highest number of any industrialized nation, while prisons remain the fastest growing industry in the country.
My people inside and out, where you at? You're listening to 99.5 FM WBAI. This radio show is called On the Count, the Prison and Criminal Justice Report. My name is Andre Ward, and as always, really honored and excited to be able to join you this evening as we are able to go into the cells and into the dormitories through the prison gates and walls by way of airways. And we're grateful to be able to be in the position to do so. And we know that those who remain inside, we always want you to know that we remain in activists in advocacy mode, representing the issues that are important to you as we join in collaboration and in partnership and in solidarity with so many activists throughout New York City, New York State, and by extension, the entire country. I'm excited, too, because I have my dear colleagues and other leaders that have joined me as a part of the On the Count Collective. And we have Harmony that joins us tonight. Harmony, how are you feeling this evening?
I'm feeling fired and motivated. It's a little muggy. I'm feeling hot outside. But shout out to my women. Shout out to all of those men and women both doing their time behind and in front of the wall. Those both fighting inside and outside, doing their freedom in a very different way. Shout out to the commemoration of the 50-year anniversary of the Attica Uprising. And shout out to you, you and you, my brothers and sisters who are listening. And shout out to my sister, who is not with us this evening, but definitely with us in spirit and in truth. We are definitely excited about this particular show. And once again, we're just waiting to hear from you, you and you, because I'm still waiting for my letters for people who are writing, for my women in Bedford, for the women in Taconic, and the women in Rikers Island, Horizon and Crossroads, brothers and sisters, waiting to hear from you about the shows that we have been presenting and what you would like to hear. And Andre, it's good to be with you.
Yes, it's good to be with you too. And it's good to be with all of our listeners who have joined us. You know, WBAI continues to be one of the most progressive radio stations in the country. And because it's commercial free and it's listeners and community sponsored, you get the kind of programming that really looks at the issues as they are, not as they're dressed up to be necessarily. And sometimes when you deal with commercialized radio programming, you may not get the kind of authentic radio programming that you need to keep you informed, to keep you aware, and equally important, to keep you inspired to be partners in the movement of social justice, the movement of economic justice, the movement of racial justice, the movement of ending mass incarceration in this country. And so you get real authentic programming here at WBAI, and we want you to continue to support this radio station and by extension this radio show On the Count, the Prisoner Criminal Justice Report, by becoming a WBAI buddy, making pledges, just showing your support. You have done that for so many years that it has allowed this 50-year-old plus radio station to remain in existence, and we know that WBAI has another 50 years that it will continue to go on as we continue to do this work and those after us will do. So just really, really happy to be with you too, Harmony, and all of our listeners as we continue to work in unison to keep WBAI in existence. You know, we're going to have people make some calls. 212-209-2877 is the number to call for people to make comments, etc. But we obviously are a day out of the 50th commemoration of the Attica Uprising. And I know we were looking to play a really powerful interview that Harmony had done with someone. And as we are looking to work out the technical kinks with that, we just want to talk a little bit about that. Then later on in the hour, we are going to have some guests to talk about housing discrimination for people who have histories of involvement in the criminal legal system. What's important is that on September 23rd, there is going to be a stated hearing with City Council. And during that time, the Bill 2047, which will end the practice of discriminating against people with criminal legal histories for housing. And it's a really important and crucial bill here in New York City, that the end of discrimination for housing against people who have histories of involvement in the criminal legal system will end. And it's been decades upon decades of this kind of discriminatory practice. So with this bill being passed, it will end that practice of discrimination. Following that will need to be enforcement. But on September 23rd, there will be a stated meeting to decide on voting for this bill. And we are urging the current speaker, City Council Corey Johnson, to vote on the bill and to pass it. So we look forward to that. That's really, really exciting. And we are looking forward to making sure that passes. Some other things to note too, and Harmony and I talked a little bit about this. Tomorrow there's going to be a rally held in front of City Hall. at 9 a.m. We're encouraging everyone to come out tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. to rally in front of City Hall to end the abuse, to end the inhumanity that exists on Rikers Island at this point. And so right now, the Crimes Committee will be holding a hearing tomorrow. People will be testifying starting at 10 a.m. And you can access that by going to the City Council website tomorrow at 10 a.m. to hear testimonies of advocates and activists to end the inhumanity, the abuse, the neglect that is currently existing on Rikers Island. So first, there will be a rally tomorrow in front of City Hall at 9 a.m. You can come, you can join. Again, that's tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. in front of City Hall, a rally to protest the abuse and the harms that are caused on Rikers Island and the neglect. And then following that, at 10 a.m., the virtual hearings will begin where people from the advocacy and activist communities will begin to testify and talk about why it is so important to decarcerate, why it is important to end the culture in corrections as it relates to the wall of silence and the lies and the abuse that oftentimes occur by the hands of correction officers against people that are detained or incarcerated on Rikers. And we want you to join and participate in that. It's very, very important. Harmony?
Absolutely. And we will definitely be out in full numbers and hope that you will join us. Yeah. I now have our recording from earlier this week with the producer of one of the movies that they have on HBO Max, the producer Mike Hull, who is definitely a supporter of criminal justice, and we had him on the show, and I just want to play a bit of that interview for our listeners because I thought it was phenomenal. And also, he's still in New York and going around and meeting with people, not just people in the criminal justice realm, but also people who remember the Attica uprising, and interviewing them because he wants to put together a piece that shows the support around the brothers who we had an opportunity to meet and see. So if it with no further ado, we're going to go ahead and play and let you guys hear just a bit of what we were talking about. Hold on.
Yeah, I don't hear it yet, Harmony.
Sorry, you can't hear it. I'm here thinking it's playing.
And it's perfectly fine. Yeah, it's perfectly fine as we work to cue that up. I know that Max, you know, obviously our engineer who is with us this evening, and a big shout out to Max, who obviously was looking to make his adjustments with playing the pre-recorded show. And we thank you, Max, for that. And we know that sometimes there are technical difficulties that occur when trying to put these things together. So thank you for your patience. But you, the listener, can call in at 212-209-2877 is the number to call while we work that out. The Attica is symbolic. And just to talk about that for our listeners who have just joined us, the Attica uprising occurred on September 9th, 1971. And just for some historical context, you know, during that time, you think about what was happening in the 1960s. And during the 1960s, you had the civil rights movement following the passage of the Civil Rights Bill in 1965. You still had the emergence of groups like the Black Panthers, the Young Lords, the Nation of Islam had been present there in that time. You had the Weatherground folk who were also involved in being really changing society from a radically different perspective than simply the passage of a bill that, in effect, on paper, desegregated, yet the idea of segregation and discrimination and racism still existed very much so during that time. But one of the things that was significant about that period prior to the September 9th uprising at Attica Correctional Facility was the murder of our dear brother, comrade, and it's interesting that I would not remember his name, as I was talking to David Rothenberg earlier today about that. But George, and it's interesting, I'm on live radio getting stuck, Harmony, about someone's name, and I read his book, Soledad Brothers and Blood in My Eye. But my dear comrade, and someone who passed away, his name was, and that means, am I getting old, Harmony, or something? I'm not forgetting people's names and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
George who?
Yeah, don't get me wrong. George Jackson, I'm sorry.
George Jackson, yes.
Yeah. And so George Jackson had been a political prisoner in Soledad Prison in California. And right before the Attica uprising, he had been killed in the yard in that prison in Soledad, California. The word was that he had a gun in his afro. Now, unless someone's afro is made of like steel wool or pure steel or something to that effect, I don't know if someone's strands of hair is able to hold a gun in their afro necessarily. But it was trumped up lies about George having a gun in his afro, and as a result, they shot him to death in the prison yard. So following that, obviously, when you think about Attica, many of the conscious men who were incarcerated at the time had been keenly aware of George Jackson's views, a lot of his ideals and ideas, and the books and writings that he had put together. So that kind of consciousness really sparked unity among the men who were inside of Attica Prison. And so as it happened, there were two men who were incarcerated at Rikers who were simply horseplaying at the time. And the officers who were there took those two men who were horseplaying and put them inside solitary confinement. And George Jackson's death, coupled with the fact that they would take two men who were just simply horseplaying, putting them into solitary confinement, coupled with the horrendous and abhorrent conditions that existed during the time in Attica, caused the men to rebel. And so there was a takeover that occurred. But the conditions under which these men were at the time needs to be noted. Those conditions were that men were oftentimes maybe given a shower once a week, were not actually able to access soap, maybe weekly. Men were able to only see their loved ones through mesh kind of like fences, like mesh kind of like tables, settings. The letters that men received while they were incarcerated were opened by the correction officers frequently. Medical care was horrible. And to top it off, racism was blatant. And so all of these factors, George Jackson's death, two men horseplaying and being put in solitary confinement, and then all of these other conditions that really spoke to the inhumanity that the men who were incarcerated at Attica during the time faced, caused the uprising. So there was an overtaking of the jail, an overtaking of the prison. There were hostages that were taken. There were negotiations that subsequently followed. But then there was an officer who was killed. And that officer who was killed, they said the incarcerated men were the ones responsible for it. And of course, it wasn't true. Yet, following that, the men who are inside experience one of the most horrible, most bloody prison rebellions in the United States history. And so under Nelson Rockefeller, he ordered the state police and the military to shoot, to kill those who were in Attica Yard at the time. There were 43 people whose lives were claimed, 10 of whom were civilians and correction officers. The other 33 were incarcerated men. And the news media at the time certainly did not support in a favorable way the men who were incarcerated at the time that were simply trying to have their humanity honored and respected. And the media lied. The media said that the 10 civilians that were killed, correction officers and civilians that were killed as a result of their throats being cut by those who were incarcerated in Attica. Later on, the truth came out when a coroner who conducted the autopsies stated that all of the people who were killed at the time were killed by bullets. And so we see all of that and we reflect on what has happened during the Attica uprising that lasted for 5 days from September 9th, 1971 to September 13th. And during that bloody Holocaust of an experience during the Attica uprising, we realize how many people suffered. Many of the families of those who were killed and who were incarcerated were sometimes unable to access the bodies of their loved ones. They weren't able to bring their loved ones to burial sites where their own families would be. Some didn't have money to be able to have the bodies transported, to be able to be brought to cemeteries of their choosing. And during that period, there was also some activism involved. There were groups who went into the prison to negotiate prior to all of the folk being killed. And we want to acknowledge all of the organizations, the members of different groups, lawyers, activists, actors, people who just were concerned about the conditions of the men. We want to acknowledge them for their sacrifice and their work and their support. And you know, Harmony, it's a lot. So I'm just reflecting, Harmony, and giving some context.
Yeah, we absolutely appreciate that. And that was, we were able to cue up the interview, but what we're going to do is just hold off because the interview is a wealth of information, and we're going to play that for our listening audience on another day. But he actually has all, it was a, one of the lawyers' name was Miss Liz, and she was given carte blanche to go down into the police department's archives. At first they were watching her every time she went, but she came so often until they just let her go into a room, and she was able to pull out the actual photos of the autopsies and all of the information, which is public information on AtticaIsAllOfUs.com. And he is willing to share what he has. And he had Michael Hall, shout out to him. He had gotten that information from her before she was, unfortunately, she passed away, but she wanted someone to have it so that people would be able to take it and use it for the future and as well as for the cases that those brothers had. So it was a wealth of information that he had given us. And I want our listeners, especially those who are starting movements as well, to know that we're building on blocks that had already been built as a foundation. But to go and look at Attica.com and look at those archivals so that they'll be able to tap into that information. He's made it public domain. He doesn't feel that anybody should own it because it is on the backs of our brothers and their families. And we have been in a lot of different forums on this week, to be totally honest with you. I learned a lot to be a part of Alliance for Justice, Alliance for Family Justice, with Sophia Elijah, our sister, who comes on sometimes as a producer on WBAI, but to bring those individuals together and to talk to them and to be able to walk with them and just hear the rich history of who they are now and all the work that they have done. And again, sometimes we don't realize, and I said this on the 9th, we don't realize the shoulders that we actually are standing on. When people say your ancestors, we think of our grandmother, our great grandma, or aunties, but we don't realize that in this movement that we are standing on so many of our ancestors. And some of them, thank God, we have a chance to still meet, to tell us, like Mr. Larkin's, the interview that you did, and so many others, we have a chance to talk to them, understand a movement, and also, you know, love on them because they have paved the way for us and have taught us how to stay steadfast and immovable about the things that we want to change in this time.
Yeah, absolutely, Harmony. And I want to thank you for conducting that powerful interview that we will play for our listening audience either Saturday or next Tuesday. So you can tune in to On the Count this Saturday from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. and Tuesday evenings, like tonight, from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. So we will play that powerful interview, Harmony, that you conducted either this Saturday or next Tuesday, because our listeners certainly need to understand a bit more the importance of all of that. As formerly incarcerated people, we are beneficiaries off of the sacrifice and legacy of those who died during the Attica Uprising and those who yet still live among us, who carry on that legacy and that history and live it out through telling it. And so it's so important for us to be able to have been incarcerated, to have phone calls, right, to have contact visits, to access law libraries, to be able to have a television inside of our cell, to be able to be in the recreational yard 2-3 hours, to be able to access soap daily, to showers daily. All of that is a direct result of the 33 people whose lives were lost that were incarcerated. And this is in no way to diminish the value and sacredness of life of those other 10 civilians who were killed. However, those 33 men who died during the Attica Uprising died so that all of us who have gone through the incarceration experience could be beneficiaries off of their legacy and to be able to access resources that they did not have access to at all. Better lighting, access to college for those who went to college while incarcerated. Back then, when the lights were turned off in Attica, they were off at 6 p.m., 6:30, 7 p.m. So you didn't have lights, right, to read. You had to use the light that was in the hallway to try to read a book or something to that effect. So the conditions were horrible and inhumane. And it's not to suggest that they have completely changed in prisons and jails throughout the country, yet the conditions are a bit better in comparison to what happened and what was existing in New York State prisons in 1971. So it's really, really important. We will be transitioning, I believe, to a music selection and a few, and then following that, we will have our guests join us for the second part of our show to talk about discrimination in housing against people who have histories of involvement in the criminal legal system. And so, you know, Harmony, I know Madi isn't with us, but she's with us in spirit, our Latinx Affairs producer, for whom we are really grateful for. She is always like behind the scenes, but also in front of the scenes, making a lot of things happen. And we look forward to, especially going into the new year, as we prepare for it, right? More Latinx shows representing the interests of our Latinx community as well. And just as a point of information, going into the next year, on February of 2022, it will mark the 20th anniversary of On the Count. And so we're really, really excited. We have some major announcements, et cetera.
Woo-hoo!
But in next year, in February of 2022, it will mark the 20th year of On the Count being on WBAI. And we just really want to acknowledge WBAI for allowing this very important program, On the Count, the Prison and Criminal Legal Reform Report, to remain in existence and to see the value in all that we have brought and all that we do. And we're thankful eternally for the sacrifice and the example and vision of Eddie Ellis, who is the founder of this radio show. And we speak from posthumously, but Eddie passed away in July of 2014. He transitioned to our ancestors. But Eddie's vision of having a radio show that exclusively hosted, produced, and ran by formerly incarcerated leaders was just revolutionary. And we thank Eddie, obviously, for his sacrifice. And I know we were looking to have a musical selection. If we don't, Harmony, I know that you can sing.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, sure, that was our little joke. But she can sing too. Right?
I certainly can, but I'm not.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so, yes, we definitely will be singing around Christmas time. Max, do we have our song? I don't know what happened to our producer. He's probably somewhere chilling out. But in any event, I see that our bright and shining guests are showing up.
You
They're
can
joining
have
us. Yes.
In your hands.
Yes. Thank you.
Anyone can ever have, but it's all worthless treasure. True worth is only measured not by what you got, but what you got in your heart. You can have everything. But what does it mean? It all means nothing if you don't stand up for something. You can't just talk the talk. You got to walk that walk. Yes, you do. It all means nothing if you don't stand up for something. And I stand up for you. And I stand up for you. Yes, I will. Yes, I will. You do the best, do the best that you can do. Then you can look in the mirror, proud of who's looking back at you. Define the life you're living, not by what you take, but what you're giving. And if you bet on love, there's no way you'll ever lose.
Just to take a stand, the greater plan's the creator's plan. Let's all rise like the day began. Reach out and touch with the Savior's hand. On rock we stand like his native land. Let the ways of love be the ways of man.
Yeah, one of our favorites, Harmony, one of our favorites. Stand Up. That's Audra Day and Common. Really powerful song. And so I think it's also appropriate and consistent with our next segment, because the work that the folk who are about to get on obviously embodies standing up for people, challenging systems. And so we want to really transition right into that. As this next segment will focus on housing discrimination based on criminal justice involvement and the use of screening reports. And so we have joined with us this evening, we have Kate Scott, who serves as the executive director of the Equal Rights Center. We have Michael Chin, who serves as the enforcement manager, or the manager of enforcement with the Seattle Office of Civil Rights. And we have Tara Benedict, who is a housing advocate at the Fortune Society. And so I want to just thank all of you for joining. Tara, Kate, Michael, thank you for joining us here on Account. How are each of you feeling this evening?
Thank you. Good to be here.
Kate, how are you feeling?
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm a little tired, but I'm excited to have this conversation.
Absolutely. And Kate, I know, obviously, working, coming home, and Tabor and Michael will make this brief but thorough as best we can and informative for our listening audience, as I know it'll be. And so, Michael, thanks for joining us, too. You're no stranger to me and obviously to Tabor and maybe even to Kate. But Mike, thank you for joining us again.
Yeah, thank you so much, Andre, for inviting me back to your show. It's always been a pleasure to be part of this.
Absolutely. So, you know, the Department of Justice has estimated that one in every three adults in the United States has either an arrest or conviction record. As we know, right, the criminal justice history information is readily available through accessible background checks. And in today's age of online public records and digital transmission, right, like a rental applicant's complete residency history, credit report, criminal report, civil litigation background, and other information like are available within hours or even minutes online. And generally speaking, you know, these are all done at the prospective tenant's expense. And so the use of background screenings is almost ubiquitous, and most landlords or housing providers heavily rely on them to exclude people with former criminal justice involvement. And to speak a little bit more about it, you know, this type of housing discrimination may be seen as part of a broader movement of society over the last few decades that's just deemed like institutional kind of exclusion, and which assumes that people are irredeemable and uses what's on paper to really like dehumanize people rather than depicting them as individuals. And so in addition to facilitating discrimination, the use of screening reports, which are meant to improve public safety, is also not even effective. In fact, there is no real empirical evidence establishing a relationship between a criminal record and an unsuccessful tenancy. And I'm gonna say that again, because that's really important to note, right? There's no empirical evidence establishing a relationship between a criminal record and an unsuccessful tenancy. In other words, right, people's criminal having a history of legal involvement in the criminal legal system has no real bearing on unsuccessful tenancy, and there's no data and research to support that. But the widespread use of background checks and resulting exclusion of people who have criminal justice involvement from access to affordable housing leads to thousands of people remaining homeless and the perpetuation of segregation in America. One of the things Tabor and I know and his colleagues is that over 50% of people that are being released to New York City from New York State prisons are entering into shelters that are uninhabitable, obviously unsafe for people, and certainly cannot support with people living a life of contribution, which by extension would contribute to public safety. So our discussion this evening is really focused on understanding housing discrimination based on criminal justice involvement, the related impact of screening reports, the work that Fortune and other organizations have done to address housing discrimination based on criminal justice involvement, and reasons to have hope for the future. So I'm going to jump right into it and just start asking folk questions. And I'll start with Tabra and then Mike and then Kate. In terms of the impact on background checks in your work, Tabra, have you ever seen a person who got an apartment after a landlord was made aware or discovered criminal justice involvement for such a person? And explain the context and whether this is a typical scenario in your experience, as brief as you can.
Absolutely. And thanks to all. First of all, I just want to say thank you, Andre, for having me on the show. And thank you so much for what you have done and what you do for the New York City community. I'm very grateful to work with you and others at Fortune. And personally, you have empowered me and inspired me along the way. And I just really want to, you know, throw some gratitude towards you in this show. So thank you very much for that. This is a very interesting question. You know, in my experience, I've only seen one person out of dozens that I've worked with directly and hundreds that I've read about or researched or read cases about obtain an apartment or housing after a landlord was made aware organically of the person's criminal justice involvement. What I mean by organically is applied for an apartment, then a check was run, the criminal justice involvement was discovered, and either that was it, or there was some kind of, you know, individualized quote unquote review, which doesn't always result in a positive result. I have not seen that very frequently. We did have one person who overcame these barriers. And I want to explain the context a little bit. This person had committed a crime, burglary, when he was about 17. He did his time in prison and he really turned his life around. He overcame cancer, worked multiple jobs, volunteered at a hospital for other cancer patients, and even got a retroactive YO. Yet for over 2 years, landlords denied him housing exclusively based on his criminal justice involvement, and in some cases, because he was trying to use a Section 8 voucher. In January of this year, we began advocating for this young man, and about 4 months later, two landlords who had blocked him or denied him reversed course or removed their blocks and approved him for an apartment. I'll tell you, when he messaged me that he had actually moved in, it was one of the most rewarding experiences of my career. However, it took a team of sophisticated people to advocating on his behalf and helping him to advocate on his behalf. And in most other cases, people don't have that kind of firepower. And in dozens of other cases that I've directly worked on, and in hundreds of others, as I alluded to before, once criminal justice involvement has been determined, there are complete and utter barriers to access. Sometimes Fortune has success with smaller landlords, but the lion's share of affordable housing, at least in New York City, appears to be blocked off from anyone with criminal justice involvement.
Absolutely, Tabor. And, you know, I want to shift to Kate, obviously, and you're in the Washington, Virginia area and leading the work of the Equal Rights Center. Kate, why do you think screening report checks are so ubiquitous? And what impact has this had in the D.C. Virginia region in terms of people finding affordable housing?
So those are really big questions. So the first one, in terms of why do I think screening report checks are so ubiquitous? You know, I think that has a lot to do with our overall sort of cultural obsession with being able to know lots of information about people on a moment's notice. Obviously, you know, 40, 50 years ago, it wasn't possible for landlords to get this sort of information about prospective tenants in a really quick way. In fact, it wasn't possible for them to get the information in a nationalized way either. You know, if they were really interested, maybe they could go down to the local courthouse and look for records. But it's really with the advent of the internet and access to massive amounts of data that this has become a common practice in the housing industry. You know, when I talk with housing providers about their decision to use screening practices like this, I hear a lot of, you know, misinformed statements about the idea that somebody's involvement in the criminal legal system should somehow affect their ability to be a good tenant or not. And that's just not true. You mentioned that earlier. You know, there's not empirical data that shows that those things are related to each other for the most part. And the reality is that everybody needs a safe place to live, regardless of their involvement with the criminal legal system. You know, in terms of the impact that it's had on the region where my organization operates, which is the greater Washington, D.C. region, you know, it's had a really devastating impact on some of the people that are most vulnerable when it comes to finding safe and secure housing to begin with. One thing that we haven't mentioned is the the disparate impact that these sorts of policies and practices have in terms of race. So we know that the criminal legal system has had a disparate impact on Black and Brown people in this country across the board. And so that means that there are trickle-down effects when it comes to things like housing and people's ability to find housing that meets their needs. So in many instances, it's just become, you know, another barrier that people have to overcome in order to meet those needs. And oftentimes, as Taber said, it's insurmountable.
Absolutely, Kate. And, you know, it has a lot to do more with fear than fact.
Right.
Would that assessment be correct, or that statement be correct, Kate?
Oh, I absolutely think that's correct.
Yeah, so it's about that too. And so I want to transition to Mike now. And, you know, you do this work in Seattle. Your work is incredibly important, Mike. And could you explain, like, how the Seattle Fair Chance Ordinance deals with background checks and how you have had used outreach and education to screening companies to help enforce the law?
Absolutely, Andre. So back in February 19, 2018, the Seattle Fair Chance Housing Ordinance went into effect. And we basically were the first law in the country that really did a blanket ban, prohibit landlords or their agents from asking about a person's criminal records or denying an application because of their criminal history. And it also included in the law that landlords cannot advertise that they screen or will not consider applicants or tenants with a criminal history. And it also required housing providers to place on their application that they cannot ask about a person's criminal history or even try to inquire about this information. And so this is the type of law that went into effect back in 2018. And one of the things that I have seen since the law went into place is that it hasn't affected landlords in how they operate their business or even screening applicants on other ways. And so here's the thing about this law is that this law has been extremely protective, but we also know that this law has not really, that we still see forms of discrimination still occurring, where in our testing, what we have done at the Seattle Office for Civil Rights, we've done a lot of testing where we would send matched pairs out and one person discloses that they have a felony on their record. And another tester goes and says they don't have any sort of, there's no discussion or anything about their felony. And we also monitor, like, how are they really treated? So when Kate is talking about bias, about how these biases exist with people with criminal history, it starts at that first initial contact. When they have that first initial contact, whether it's on the phone, whether it's in person, whether it's by email, about how it automatically places those individuals at a huge disadvantage. And it's not even just getting to the point of screening, it's discouraging them from even considering applying or even telling them, I'm sorry, this unit is not available. These are all forms of discrimination, whether it's explicit or implicit messages sent to these testers. And I know that this happens day and, you know, to lots of folks who are looking for housing. One question that you did ask, Andre, has to do with screening companies. And so one of the things that we did, we had a three-prong approach when this law went into practice. Number one, we did extensive outreach to tenants and tenant advocacy organizations to let them know what this law is. We reached out to reentry organizations who help people with criminal histories who are coming out of the criminal justice system who are looking for housing in Seattle. To know about what their rights are. We met with housing providers, whether it's small landlords to larger landlords, property management companies to understand what are the requirements that they have to uphold the law. But the third thing that we did was we actually went upstream. We went to the root of who was actually providing screening for housing providers. And we met and did considerable outreach to some of the largest screening companies in Washington state and basically brought them in and said, here's this new law. And not only is this a law that landlords have to follow, but screening companies are also required to follow the law because this law is much broader than just landlords and property managers. It also includes anyone cannot ask or inquire about a person's criminal history. And that made a huge impact because that automatically put into motion companies not even offering or not even allowed to even provide that sort of information to landlords who might want that information as part of their screening criteria. Also, one other thing too is that through this sort of outreach, housing providers also listen to screening companies. And so part of the outreach also was landlords getting that firsthand information from screening companies saying, hey, we're not going to offer this, and here's why. And so these are some are tactics that we did to ensure that people knew about this new law. And it has been effective because we do get screening companies that do contact us and say, hey, we do have landlords asking for this information, but we don't offer that.
Got it. Thank you for that, Mike, too. I appreciate that. And we have maybe about 3 or 4 minutes left. So just want to get this last question into folk, and this is to the group. And I'll start with Kate. What do you think about, you know, the argument that, you know, ideally background checks should not be considered at all, because once criminal justice is known, not just intentional discrimination will occur, but also discrimination based on subconscious or implicit bias. So I'll start with you, Kate. Then we'll follow with Tabor. And I know, Mike, you touched on this a little bit. We'll end with you in the next 2 minutes or so.
And while you're saying that, hi, this is Harmony, could you please just add for me, if it's not the criminal justice background, then it's the credit background. To me, it's still the same core about racism. So just add a little bit about that to me, because we can stop them from looking in our backgrounds. We can stop them from looking at our credit checks. But to me, there is a core that we're not really touching on a bit. And that is the people. It is Black and brown people of color or people who are in poverty.
Sure. So that's actually where I was going to start off. You know, I've been working with the Equal Rights Center for about 6 years now, but I prior to that did fair housing work in New Orleans. And we looked into that this issue there and found pretty convincingly that criminal background screening was being used as a proxy for race discrimination in housing transactions. So I think, you know, that is very important to shine a light on and be clear about, that in many instances, these are tools that are being used to hide what some landlords are trying to do when it comes to race discrimination. I am a fan of the idea that the gold standard should be that we're not considering background checks at all, and credit checks for that matter, although I don't think we have time to go into that. You know, I think that that works in some communities, in some more progressive communities, although I don't want to, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater and not consider other interventions that could make sense in places where that might not be a political reality. But I think, you know, overall, that is the best solution to the problem that's on the table right now. And in regards to Harmony's question, you know, what that would do is make it easier to identify that race discrimination is happening. If housing providers aren't able to hide behind criminal record screening or credit screening, then it makes it easier to shine a light on the race discrimination that's happening. So I think that's a really important step that we could take in terms of, you know, movement towards justice and housing rights for everybody.
Tabor, in 30 seconds, we have about maybe a minute or so left. So if you can give us something in answer to that question, thank you. Tabor?
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry. I find this argument very compelling, and I've actually discussed this with Kate, and I agree with everything that she said. Where it's not politically viable, the best that you can do is probably delaying the screening with, you know, ban the box type models. I just would suggest there are reasons I'm not going to go into a little bit more detail that I'd like to give, but we don't have much time. But I would just ask people, listeners and others on the panel, to do a little bit of a thought experiment and think about how they would choose with that information. Because I recently asked a family member this question, and even though they had multiple family members in prison and helped and supported them and loved them, they too were choosing the person without criminal justice involvement when they had a choice between someone with and someone without. To me, this is really about institutional exclusion, disparate impact on people of color, and the perpetuation of segregation and neighborhood isolation. that's definitely the case here in New York, as I think, Andre, you're aware. And I think anytime you consider this, it's just a tool for, as others have suggested, it's a new tool to use for, in a way, race-based discrimination, in my opinion. So I think this is at the forefront of the civil rights movement in terms of affordable housing. And I'm just very happy and grateful to be a part of this this work. But yeah, I definitely feel like taking away the consideration of it is the way to go because of implicit and subconscious bias.
Thank you. Mike, you have 10 seconds. Sorry.
Yeah. For me, I think it really matters. What we need to really center is the people who are most impacted by these policies and practices, which are Black and brown people. And until we actually reckon the importance of how we address racism in housing and employment and in other areas and really discuss the intersections of this, we will never be able to address all of the issues that we're really talking about. Like, I think that this is just a Band-Aid to a much more of a larger systemic issue that's at play right now.
Absolutely. Kate, Tabor, Mike, thanks so much for joining us. Sorry we didn't have enough time. We will certainly get you guys back on, maybe at a much earlier time, Kate and others, so that you can obviously have enough time and be restful and not be in your day, as I'm sure all of you have been incredibly busy. And so we want to thank you for joining on the count tonight. There is the Fair Chance for Housing bill that's looking to be passed. There's a stated meeting on September 23rd at City Council where that bill will be voted on. And we simply need the City Council Speaker, Corey Johnson, to vote on that bill. And we will have the Fair Chance for Housing Act passed in New York City. And then the second part of that is what Mike does is enforcement, making sure once the bill is passed, it is enforced. On behalf of the entire On the Count team, Harmony, our dear colleague and sister and Latinx Affairs producer, Madi, we thank all of you for joining and thank our dear engineer, Max. As we always say before closing, don't give in, don't give out, don't give up. Stand tall in spite of it all and stay. On the count.
On the count.
The U.S. prison system incarcerates approximately 2.5 million people, the highest number of any industrialized nation, while prisons remain the fastest growing industry in the country.
Extinction Diaries. The Gobi Bear is the only bear in the world that lives exclusively in a desert. The Gobi is also the world's rarest bear and critically endangered. There are less than 40 in the wild and none known to exist in captivity. The Mongolian government is dedicating funds and territory protection to stop the extinction in one of the world's most inhospitable environments. Giant sand dunes, ice canyons, raging wind, cold and heat are all characteristics of the Gobi Bear's home, and it is human activity again driving the race to extinction. International mining operations are polluting the desert while extracting coal, copper, and gold from the region. And seasonal grasslands, vital to all wildlife, is being destroyed by overgrazing domesticated livestock. Gobi bears travel great distances from oasis to oasis, and because humans, including poachers and illegal miners, depend on the same oasis water supplies, the outcome for the bears is often tragic. In 2014, the Gobi's numbers fell to under 30 and have since risen. There is hope. They need more love. My name is Rising Moon, and this is a Small World Radio production.
WBAI accepts snowmobiles. If you have a snowmobile, we want it. We also want any extra cars, trucks, SUVs, RVs, boats, and more. Any reason is a good reason to give a vehicle to WBAI. Some do it to avoid the hassles of selling. Some like to skip the costs of repairing, while others just enjoy the good feelings of giving back to their community. But no matter your reason, donating a vehicle to WBAI is a great idea. And it's easy. Here's how it works. Simply call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or give online at WBAI.com.
wbai.org/donateyourcar. Our vehicle donor support team will arrange your free pickup. When the driver arrives to tow away your great gift, you'll receive a donation receipt.